If you're at all into gut health, you're probably already pretty well versed in probiotics. But what about prebiotics? And no, we're not just talking about dietary fiber. In fact, we're going to talk about what makes prebiotics different from dietary fiber and why you want both in your life. Hello, friends. My name is Desiree Nielsen, and you are listening to the All Sorts podcast, where we're on a mission to make wellness not suck. I started this podcast because I wanted to create a space where you could access evidence-based, positive, and actually useful information about taking care of yourself. Because if wellness doesn't make you feel good, what's the point? And today's conversation with Dr. Raylene Rimer, PhD, a researcher who has published almost 200 papers on the topic of fiber, prebiotics, and the microbiome, is going to spark your little nerd fire about a topic that doesn't get nearly enough attention in nutrition: prebiotics. We cover everything from what prebiotics actually are and where you can get them, to how they influence inflammation, blood sugar control, and more, plus specific dosages to help you tackle your health concerns. But before we get started, I have a little, well, actually, no, it's a really big announcement. My newest book, Plant Magic, is now available for pre-order, and I am so excited for you to see it. I really do believe that this is my best cooking yet. Super approachable, nourishing, and full of flavor. Oh, and there's cake. It's a book for everyone, from the plant curious to those looking for more healthy-ish recipes to help you feel better and love what you eat. You can pre-order it now from your local bookshop or wherever books are sold. Now let's dive into today's conversation with Dr. Raylene Rimer. Raylene, I'm so excited to talk to you. I mean, I have to admit that because I'm a total nerd for this stuff, the Nerdy Science podcasts are my favorite episodes. And so I'm really excited to learn more about you and learn more with you about prebiotics. Like, how did you get started down the research line of prebiotics? Like, where did your interest spark?
First of all, it's a pleasure to be here with you. My research actually started in the area of dietary fiber way back when I did my doctorate degree. And back then, we didn't really know too much about prebiotic fiber, which we'll talk about today, but really looking at what's the benefit of dietary fiber for a lot of the diseases that are just really relevant to Canadians. So diabetes was the disease that I looked at then. And so soon after that, the gut microbiome, or this community of bacteria and microorganisms that live in the intestine, started to gain prominence. And so dietary fiber just fits so nicely with that area of research. And, you know, today we know so much more about the link between diet and gut health. And so it just seemed to be this natural progression from, you know, very basic dietary fiber research into quite a bit more specific focus on gut microbiome and specifically prebiotic fibers.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because I think as a dietitian myself, the least sexy advice a dietitian can give is eat more fiber. Like, it sounds so crusty. You think of your grandparents, like eating bran. And, you know, thank you, microbiome, because all of a sudden, fiber is like the coolest thing that we can talk about in nutrition. Like, I love it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I that's my exact same sentiments that, you know, you used to tell people, oh, I work on dietary fiber. It's like, oh, okay, kind of shuts the conversation down. But now you can, you know, talk about the link to the gut microbiome, and everybody is interested in gut health and the microbiome. And it's just linked to so many conditions and diseases, and has so much relevance. And even in terms of the scientific publications that come out in the area, I'm just amazed at, you know, some of these really high impact publications. They're on dietary fiber. And, you know, 20, 30 years ago, I would have never suspected that a dietary fiber focused paper could, you know, be one of these top research papers that comes out. And I'm just feel so proud for nutrition and dietary fiber that it's really relevant and it's being talked about at the highest levels in science and medicine and health. And I just think that's really exciting.
Yeah, it's super exciting. So maybe we should like start at the beginning and make sure that we're all on the same page by saying prebiotic is what? Like what are we talking about when we talk about a prebiotic?
Yeah, great place to start. So I'll give the scientific definition and then I'll talk about it in practical terms. What is a prebiotic? So the official scientific definition is that it's a substrate that's selectively utilized by host microorganisms and conferring a health benefit. So there's some key parts to that official definition. But in practical terms, you can think of a prebiotic as a food for the healthy bacteria that already live in our intestinal tract, or we like to say gut for the intestinal tract. So I think it's important to contrast it between probiotics, which I think, you know, many people are very familiar today with probiotics, which is where you're actually consuming the live bacteria, the healthy bacteria. You eat them in themselves. But the prebiotic is different. So you're not consuming the bacteria themselves, but you're consuming food that is very specific and beneficial to feed those bacteria that already live down in our intestinal tract. And one of the key components to this scientific definition is that it's selectively used by these healthy bacteria. And I think that's important because you can think about it like it's a food package and you're going to deliver it down into your intestinal tract to this community of bacteria that live there. And it's specific to the healthy ones. And so it's like a package that comes to them and it's got their specific name on it. And so it's going to go to them and it's not going to go and feed the harmful bacteria that are, you know, some do live in our intestine too. So these, you know, pathogens or harmful bacteria, it's not going to feed and promote the growth of them. It's going to be very specific and selected to those healthy bacteria. So that's one part of that definition that I think is important, that we don't have to worry that a prebiotic is, you know, feeding bacteria that maybe aren't going to give us a health benefit. I think the other important thing in thinking about prebiotics is that not all non-digestible carbohydrates, like not all fibers, are considered prebiotic. And so they're, you know, it's certainly beneficial to eat a variety of different dietary fibers, but not all of them currently are recognized as proven prebiotics. And so things like beta-glucan from oats or pectin that you might find in apples, these are great fibers, but right now, according to the scientific definition and the criteria, they would be candidate prebiotics. And again, for the, you know, average consumer, the science of, is it a proven prebiotic or is it a candidate prebiotic? You know, that maybe doesn't matter. I mean, the message is we need to eat more of them. But I think from the a regulatory standpoint, consumers, we'd like the messages and the labels and the claims that are made around our foods to be accurate. So it's just good to recognize the ones that are proven are inulin, fructooligosaccharides, or sometimes called oligosaccharides, and galactooligosaccharides. So those three are the most researched and would be considered proven prebiotics and definitely have the most traditional use and the most research behind them.
And I think that's so important that you highlighted it. So because we hear a lot about fibers, we hear a lot about prebiotics. And so the idea that, you know, fibers is this huge sort of cluster of compounds that we find in food And some are fermentable, which means our microbes can use them. And some are not fermentable, which means they're still good. They might help sweep your gut clear and help you poop. But then not all of those fermentable fibers, because the definition states we have to show that there's a health benefit, not all these fermentable fibers are technically prebiotics.
Absolutely. And I think it's just important, you know, I think of health professionals, dietitians, when we talk about fibers and prebiotics, it's good for us to keep the terminology correct and use the correct terminology. And again, just to emphasize that there's so many good fiber sources. But when we talk about these biotics, so the biotics are really hot topics. So the probiotics, we should, you know, talk about them according to the latest scientific definitions. Prebiotics, we should also make sure that we use the term correctly so that, you know, there's just not misinformation around what is a prebiotic and is this product or this ingredient or this food actually prebiotic or not. So I think that's just good clarity around that.
And maybe we should start then by saying, like, where do you get the defined prebiotics? So, like, where do we find inulin, for example?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we can get them a couple ways. So the way that we like to talk is this whole food approach. So we'd like people to get prebiotics from the foods that we eat. So the foods that are rich in prebiotics would be things like garlic and onions. You can find it in some fruits like nectarines, honeydew melon contain inulin. Beets are, you know, red beets have it. And whole grain wheat is also another source. And if we think about our Western, our typical North American diet, where would people get the most prebiotic in their diet? It actually comes from bread or from wheat. And so they've done some research and they show that, you know, 78% of our inulin or our prebiotic intake in a typical North American is actually coming from wheat, just because we eat a lot more bread than we eat, you know, maybe of garlic and onions and some of these other things. And then onions were actually the next contributor at 10%. But there's other foods that have high amounts of prebiotics that I think probably aren't as common and you don't see as many recipes around them and whatnot. So Jerusalem artichoke, or it could be called sunchoke, that is really high in prebiotic and inulin. So that would be another food that people could try, you know, try a recipe, buy it in the grocery store. And then I guess the other place you could go to supplements. And so this is where the food manufacturers of these supplements have extracted the inulin typically out of foods and then purified it and put it into supplement form. And from that, a lot of time the starting food is chicory root. And so chicory root by weight has a lot of inulin in it. So over 60% of the weight of the chicory root is actually inulin fiber. And so they can extract that. And so you might find supplements with inulin is probably one of the more common ones. But you can also find some with the fructooligosaccharide, the FOS, as they call it, or the GOS, the galactooligosaccharide. But I would think for a typical person looking for it, it would be inulin that they would see as the name.
And I have to say, I'm not surprised by the statistic on wheat, but I love that we have that kind of data, particularly because in like the online world, there is so much hate on for wheat. And we forget not only what a nutrient-dense food it is, but in terms of like the microbiome benefits, particularly because of this whole gluten-free charade, there are compounds in wheat that are actually very beneficial to the non-celiac microbiome.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree with that. And I guess we have to just emphasize it's the whole grain that's the best there. I mean, that's where you're going to get the most fiber, the most prebiotic, but also the other nutrients that go along with getting that whole grain. And, you know, again, outside of those who have celiac disease or, you know, really are wheat allergy and can't be eating that, there's a lot of really good nutritional benefit to it. And again, the research, if you look at the big population level studies where they have, you know, 10,000, 20,000 people that they look at their dietary habits and what's their risk of developing type 2 diabetes and these kind of things, the cereal fibers, the grains, the wheat really are very beneficial in preventing some of these diseases from developing. So yeah, there's lots of benefit there, including prebiotics.
Yeah. And I'd love to dig in a little bit more about how prebiotics work. I think the example that you use, they're essentially food for your good gut microbes, is awesome. But how do we, like, they ferment? Like, what does it mean that the bacteria ferment? And then what's the outcome of that? Like, what happens after they fermented? Are they growing? Are they producing other things because they fermented?
Yeah, and that's exactly how the prebiotics work, is that they're used by those healthy members of this bacterial community. And what it means when we say they, you know, they use them is they undergo this process of fermentation. And it's really like their digestive process where they, you know, can literally take in the prebiotics, we'll just call it the prebiotic fiber, take it in, and then they have the enzymes, which we don't have. They have the enzymes to utilize that and then give off some beneficial byproducts. And one of these beneficial byproducts is short-chain fatty acids. And these are, you know, molecules that the bacteria put out that are actually very good for our health. So they can have effects right in the intestine where they're produced. So the bacteria would give them off and they would circulate in the intestine. And so for our intestinal cells, one of these short-chain fatty acids is called butyrate, is very important energy source for our intestinal cells. And so as our intestinal cells turn over, as they do in normal health, this butyrate is the energy to help those intestinal cells keep renewing themselves. So that's one really important metabolite that these bacteria would give off as this byproduct. Another thing they do is to enhance our, we call it the intestinal barrier. So we want to keep the things that should stay in our intestinal tract, we want them to stay there until, you know, we excrete them. And we don't want them to leak through our intestine and get into our bloodstream. And so what the prebiotics can do is, so they're stimulating the growth of these healthy bacteria. So there's more of them there in your intestine. And their presence there and their short-chain fatty acids that they're producing strengthen that intestinal barrier so that things that shouldn't leak through there, like whole bacteria or bits of bacteria, we call it LPS. So if these things get into your bloodstream, they can cause inflammation. And so what the prebiotics can do is just really ensure that that barrier is nice and tight, and things that should stay on this side of the gut stay here and they don't get into our bloodstream. So that's a really important one, I think, is that preventing that low-grade inflammation, because we now know from the research that inflammation, this low-grade inflammation that could start in the gut, can be linked to things like insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes or osteoarthritis, and, you know, heart disease can start maybe even start at the gut when this barrier breaks down. So those are some of the key things that these prebiotics do, and it's why they can then, again, in that official definition, give us this health benefit because of some of the byproducts that they give off just naturally as part of their metabolism. But we, as the host, as the person who ate the prebiotic, get the benefit from what they're doing, metabolizing and digesting that prebiotic.
I love that idea that we feed them and then they feed us back again.
Yes.
But that also, too, the idea that when we are eating a diverse diet, rich with different fermentable fibers and prebiotics, that that healthy gut is helping us prevent a whole host of things, you know, because I'm primarily a digestive dietitian. So we talk about IBS and Crohn's disease. You know, people sort of get that idea that, like, if something's going on with your gut, you got to fix that. But I think often what people don't realize is that a healthy, functioning, intact gut barrier and, like, a healthy microbiome also contributes to risk of things like type 2 diabetes, which we don't even think about as being connected at all to our digestive tract.
Yeah, and it's interesting because another very common word that you hear now is this gut microbiota brain axis or gut microbiota muscle axis. So this kind of two-way highway, this communication that occurs between our gut and the gut microbiota and distant sites. So like you say, it's not just an effect that they have in the intestinal tract, which we can understand more easily because it's right there. They're next to each other. But how do the bacteria, when they're contained within that intestine, how could they affect something in your brain? So how could they affect mood or anxiety or these kind of things, or type 2 diabetes, which is like regulating your blood glucose? And so it's really interesting, and the research is, I think, just exploding in this area and really understanding what is this communication that's occurring along these axes between the microbiota and these other organs in our body and other systems. And it's just really fascinating, some of the research that's coming out in that area.
Well, maybe now's a good time to sort of dig into some of that specific research about prebiotics. Like, what do we know in terms of, like, supplementing prebiotics in the diet and inflammation? Maybe let's start there because that's where we're at. Is, like, what do we know about prebiotics and inflammation, or more the cardiometabolic effects?
Right. So that's some of the initial work actually started in that. I mean, the digestive effects and the effects on the microbiome, those were kind of the pioneer studies. But then once they started to think that maybe there's potential for other conditions or diseases, it was really those cardiometabolic inflammatory diseases that, you know, the researchers, the scientists started to look at. And so I think it's important because there's research that's been done across a lot of different countries, a lot of different populations, younger, older individuals. You know, some are healthy in these studies, others have a specific disease or condition already. And so sometimes they pull all of that research together into, like, a systematic review or a meta-analysis. And so, you know, you can start to see across larger bodies of, you know, participants and studies and research, what does the research actually show in terms of these prebiotics in here? And so I think right now we have some good evidence that the prebiotics, again, taken by a variety of different individuals, I think, which is important. Like, is it generalizable, or is it just, you know, so very specific, just one group? So across these different groups, you can see good evidence that it can reduce inflammation. And so when we say reduce inflammation, what they're really looking at is it's typically a blood test. And so within the blood, you can see some of these markers of inflammation. So C-reactive protein is one of them. And if you go to your doctor, they can, you know, do a blood test for C-reactive protein, CRP. And so this is one inflammatory marker that they've seen across a lot of these studies when they're put together that, yes, we can reduce this marker. Other things that they've seen is, I mentioned this LPS. So this compound, it's from bacteria. It shouldn't be leaking across from our intestine into our bloodstream. And so it's would be a marker of a leaky gut or this barrier that's not performing very well. So they can see reductions in the amount of that LPS in the blood too. So as far as inflammation, I think there's, you know, some good solid evidence and, you know, probably will keep growing as more studies are done. The other area that they've looked at, where I think the evidence is really, the research is really good, is in terms of blood glucose or, you know, what's your blood sugar levels, and particularly after an individual eats. So you eat a meal or eat a snack or whatever, and so if you've got these prebiotics that individuals are taking, typically in these research studies, it's given as a supplement and they're not giving it as a food form, and they can see improvements in blood glucose control and specifically, you know, reducing blood glucose. So I think that's another really important metabolic benefit. And then also looking at body weight reductions. So, and again, here, I guess the emphasis is not so much on what's the numbers on the scale and did a person lose weight, but really we know what's more important is were they able to lose some body fat and not just numbers on the scale. And so they can see, again, a reduction. It's a slight reduction in body fat. So it's not, you know, this is not a cure for overweight and obesity, but we do see this bit of reduction in body fat. And I think what's more important is what that reduction in body fat can do metabolically for the person. So your metabolic health is really what is going to be the important aspect of that weight loss if it occurs, but being metabolically healthy. And so I think the prebiotics being able to reduce some body fat is a step in the right direction for your metabolic health.
Totally. Now, if people are listening to this and going, this all sounds very, very good. And yes, we want to diversify our plant intake so we get a diversity of fibers and fermentable fibers and prebiotics. But I'm still curious about a supplement. What do we know in terms of the research? What should people be looking for in a prebiotic supplement? And what kind of dosages are we looking at in the research?
Right. I think the first key thing is that you need to look for the specific ingredient of that supplement. So most of these prebiotics that we talked about, so the inulin, the FOS, and the GOS, so they're powder form. And so you would need to specifically look on the ingredient list of that supplement, that powder that you're buying. Is it inulin as the ingredient, or fructooligosaccharide, or galactooligosaccharide? I would caution against just looking for the word prebiotic, because not all manufacturers of prebiotics, they are maybe not necessarily adhering to that official definition. So it may or may not actually be a prebiotic. So I think the first key thing is you need to look at the ingredient list or just see what compound, what fiber are they actually selling here in this supplement. So that's the key thing. Look for the ingredient, not just the word prebiotic. And then in terms of dosage, there's a wide range of dosages that have been looked at in the literature. And so I think the key thing is at that lower end, so that they suspect you need at least 3 grams per day to get this impact on your microbiome. So to enhance these healthy bacteria. So there's kind of a minimum dose that you need. So you could, it's probably a little bit hard to get that from food. Again, from our Western North American diet, the range is really 1 to 4 grams per day that you could get. Probably more people are kind of on the 1 gram dose, just thinking about those foods that have prebiotics. So, you know, you could take a little bit of a supplement every day just to get this, you know, meet this 3 gram per day dosage. So that's really for that microbiome, feeding these healthy bacteria. And then, you know, we have to think about populations or individuals, patients, where we might be using that prebiotic to target a specific symptom. So in that case, if we can think about some of the applications of prebiotics, so it could be constipation, it could be some of these cardiometabolic conditions that we've talked about, and there typically what you see is a higher dose. So research studies have, you know, gone up to 21 grams per day or higher, which is a big load of prebiotic fiber. We can talk about what some of the side effects might be from that. But most of those studies, these clinical studies, would be about this 15 gram per day dose. And you can't get that from foods. So if it's for, you know, specifically looking to manage a particular disease or condition, then you're going to have to turn to these supplements, and it would be more in that 10 to 15 gram range. Something like constipation is actually a very defined set dose for that minimum, and it's 12 grams per day, at least 12 grams per day. And we have this knowledge based on in Europe, the European Union has a health claim associated with prebiotics, which we don't have here in Canada. We don't have a specific health claim on prebiotics, but they have one there now already, and it is specific for constipation. So at a dose of at least 12 grams per day, it can enhance stool frequency, and so they do have a constipation claim there. So that's one where we have a pretty defined dose, whereas from other conditions, you're more or less, you know, you kind of have to look in the research, the studies that have been done, what have they used, what was beneficial. But again, as you know, just a general talking point, we're probably in the 10 to 15 gram per day range.
And so good that you hinted at side effects, because as a gut dietitian, you know, my IBS patients, they've heard of inulin and FOS and GOS because they're avoiding them on the low FODMAP diet, because eating these foods, these compounds can increase their symptoms. So for people, particularly in North America, we don't eat a really high fiber diet. Our bodies might not be used to these very fermentable active compounds. What might that feel like if someone were to attempt to go from 0 to 15 overnight?
Yeah. So the key message with prebiotics, and, you know, sometimes I get caught up in, you know, talking about, oh, it's, you know, so great for your microbiome, and, you know, there's all these benefits, but we have to, you know, just remember the very practical recommendations around introducing these into your diet, and that's to start low and start slow with these prebiotics, because you are putting a fuel down into your intestine now, where some of the healthy bacteria, we haven't used any specific names, but people might recognize bifidobacteria and lactobacillus. So these are two of these healthy bacteria that get fed by the prebiotics. And so they grow and bloom in the intestine when you eat the prebiotics. And they in themselves don't produce gas as one of these byproducts. But what happens is some of the short-chain fatty acids they produce, other bacteria can use them, and they are gas producers. So what we see is that people, when they start to take prebiotic fibers. Some may, and others don't. Some tolerate it extremely well, but some will get an increase in flatulence or gas. And typically, again, if we look at the research studies, that as you adapt to that increased amount of fuel going down to the gut for the bacteria, people adapt and it can definitely be reduced. In research studies, you know, you see an increase, you know, in the 2 to 4 week range. And then if you ask again a few months later, they're back to their baseline. So we know adaptation occurs, but you need to take it slow and you need to start low and you would work your way up. So, you know, we talked about that 15 gram per day dose or even the 12 gram per day for constipation. You wouldn't just tomorrow start with the 12 grams. You would start maybe with 3 or 4 and work your way up over several weeks. And that just minimizes the chance that you'd get these side effects. Now, for some individuals, like you said, irritable bowel syndrome, so IBS, it might also depend on which prebiotic specifically that they choose to maybe try in their diet. And so there's, you know, a very recent study where they took GOS, this galacto-oligosaccharide, and that seemed to, it improved symptoms in the participants who had IBS. And so maybe it's the type of prebiotic that might be more tolerable for some than maybe the inulin or the FOS. And I just think so, you know, talking about this, the FODMAP, the low FODMAP diet is, you know, used or recommended or tried by a lot of individuals with IBS. And so that's, you know, eliminating a lot of these fermentable substrates for these bacteria. So the bacteria actually, you get a lower diversity. So there's fewer number of different members of that bacterial community. And specifically, some of these really healthy bacteria, like bifidobacteria, are reduced if you're, you know, on a FODMAP, low FODMAP diet for a while. So we want to figure out, are there things, you know, if a person is using the low FODMAP, are there any prebiotics that you could add to that, that, you know, still helps them to control the symptoms, but you're improving the gut microbiota with the prebiotic there to support that healthy gut and not necessarily trigger any symptoms with it.
Well, and in our practice, you know, with our people with IBS, one of the fibers we trial the most is psyllium. And one of the reasons we use it is because it's a relatively low fermentation. But even something like psyllium contains compounds that may be helping to feed, even though they're not a defined prebiotic. Mm-hmm. Are there like other options like psyllium that might still be contributing to a healthier microbiome, even if they don't have the inulin in them?
Yeah, the psyllium is really interesting because it's a very well researched fiber, and so there's health benefits associated. Again, if we talk about, you know, the blood glucose control and lowering cholesterol or some of your lipids, so there's good evidence for health benefits of the psyllium. Again, in terms of being a proven prebiotic, it's not there yet, but definitely I think the research that's been going on, it could get there. And an interesting thing that I've seen with the psyllium research is that they're trying different, so you can use enzymes to cut up and make different sizes of this psyllium fiber and the particular type of fiber that's contained within it. And you can get different effects on the microbiome. And so, you know, we think about personalized nutrition or designer prebiotics or designer probiotics, and maybe psyllium is going to be one of these first fibers where they, you know, change it slightly to get a really targeted effect. And it's just something interesting that, you know, I think the food scientists and the nutrition scientists, they're all working together to, you know, really enhance the, I guess, the repertoire of prebiotics that we might have so that we can go beyond just the inulin and the FOS and the GOS that we know of today, and what else fits this definition.
It's so, the more that we learn about this, the more fascinated I become about it. And I feel like that is the perfect place to leave off and switch into our rapid fire questions. So a few little fun softball getting to know you types of things. So when Dr. Raylene Rimer was a child, what did she want to be when she grew up?
A teacher.
Oh, I love that. So here you are, you're teaching about your research and your science and disseminating that into the world. How many of us are actually doing totally what is aligned with what our like childhood us wanted to do? That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Do you have any secret talents or surprising hobbies?
Yes, I can play the accordion.
That's amazing. Did you start that as a kid, or is that something like that you picked up?
That was a childhood. I was taking piano lessons, didn't really love the piano lessons, but my parents said, you know what, you can't just quit music altogether. You need to pick another instrument that you're going to take lessons in. And I picked the accordion. So I took accordion lessons for many years, and I haven't taken it out for a while, but I could still play a few tunes.
That's amazing. The best thing about living in Calgary?
The close proximity to the mountains for hiking and skiing, downhill skiing, and just the beauty of it is really special.
Yeah, the Rockies are incredible. Okay, it's Friday night. Do you get takeout or do you cook?
I cook.
What do you cook?
I love to make a good curry. So when I was doing my PhD, I had one of the other PhD students, she had gone to Ghana, and the local women had taught her how to make a traditional curry, African curry. And so that is one of my most favorite dishes. And so, you know, like 30 years after my PhD and when she first cooked that for us, I still pull out that recipe and make it, and delicious.
Well, that sounds amazing. Okay, last but not least, your favorite way to get prebiotics?
Well, I do eat a lot of whole grain wheat. So for me, I probably am one of those people that contributed to that 78% coming from wheat. But, you know, I'm very curious to try. I actually saw one of your recipes for the Jerusalem artichokes, the sunchokes. So I'm going to buy those at the grocery store, and I'm going to give it a try.
We call them fartichokes in our house, yeah. And oh, do I love them.
Well, it's something new I'm going to try. I've been talking about them as this rich prebiotic source for so many years, and now I just thought, okay, it's time to actually cook them and try them, so...
Honestly, they're like a creamier potato. They are so good. They are so good. I'm definitely team sunchokes around here.
Excellent. You've convinced me. I'm going to try it.
Dr. Raylene Rimer, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and teaching us all about prebiotics today. I think it's going to really help with something that's such a hot topic, but there's not a lot of good quality information out there. And it's going to help us all be smarter consumers with healthier tummies.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
I am so excited that Dr. Raylene was able to take time out of her busy schedule to share her knowledge here on the All Sorts podcast. The field of nutrition and the microbiome is literally exploding right now. And I love knowing what's happening on the cutting edge of the science. But also, don't forget to pre-order your copy of my new book, Plant Magic. I promise it will deliver on the prebiotics you need in your life big time. Head over to my website, www.desireerd.com, to learn more about my special pre-sale offer as a thank you for pre-ordering. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the All Swords podcast, which is produced by myself and edited by Brian McCallman. We are grateful to live and work on the unceded and ancestral territory of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. If you love this episode, consider sharing it with someone you think needs to hear it, and be sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of the pod. Until next week, friends, be well.